The Most Special Beast, Chapter 12, Escape. The man refuses to walk with Quinn at his back, twisting around to track her wherever she goes, so Quinn takes the lead. Yusuf nods towards her retreating back, and the man follows after some obvious hesitation. The man keeps glancing back to find Yusuf, clearly uneasy. His left arm is tucked back across his belly, holding the cloak closed in front. The other remains up before him, dagger at the ready. Yes, they let him keep the dagger. Yusuf hopes that doesn't come back to bite them later, but he isn't about to try taking it away from him now. He also hopes Quinn doesn't tell Andromache that the man got the drop on him, but she almost certainly will. He'll have to brace himself for a lecture and extended teasing. They creep along the hallway, following one of the routes the three of them had mapped out in the days beforehand. There is no one else in the cellar, most of the castle no doubt still outside enjoying or supervising the festivities. They've timed their escape well. Yusuf watches the man from his position at the rear. He notes that though the man's legs are slightly unsteady, his bare feet make next to no sound against the floor. The cloak billows around his calves, its neatly embroidered hem rubbing against the dried blood on the man's heels. They ascend a set of stairs and emerge onto the ground floor. At their first intersection shortly after, Quinn turns left through an open door, heading down a dimly lit corridor towards a well-hidden servant's entrance. The man turns right. Yusuf hurries forward with a curse. This side of the corridor is bright and decorated, leading back into the parts of the castle meant to impress. The man is not walking very quickly, and Yusuf catches up after only a few strides. His hand comes down on the man's shoulder, prompting him to spin around, dagger first. Yusuf leaps back and narrowly avoids a sliced throat. "Easy," he hisses. "It's only me." The man glares at him, not lowering the dagger from its defensive position. "We need to go the other way," Yusuf says, pointing to where Quinn is waiting impatiently. The man takes a step backwards and throws a glance behind him. "That way leads to the guest suites," Yusuf says, shaking his head urgently. "We need to go this way. We need to stay unseen." Turning his head, the man looks again at something down the hall. Is he looking at the table of odds and ends up against one wall? The tapestry? The windows. The setting sun casts a fierce orange glow over the corridor. The man's pale face is bathed in color, and the light shines in his eyes as he stares wistfully towards the windows set deep into the walls. The view of the outdoors isn't visible from this angle. Yusuf's heart aches, but there's no time. "We will be outside soon," Yusuf tells him, carefully grasping a bit of the man's cloak. "You will see the sunset, I promise." He gives a little tug, and the man tears his gaze away from the light to glare anew at Yusuf. I know, Yusuf soothes. He darts a look back at Quinn. She looks like she's reconsidering letting the man walk free. Yusuf pulls harder. He doesn't want to kill the man to save him. "Please trust me. Come with me now." To his relief, the man casts one look at the windows and then obeys. Yusuf keeps holding on to the man's cloak, and the man follows just behind him. Yusuf half expects to feel a dagger through his back at any moment. He nervously looks back every few steps to find the man already staring back. He wonders what makes the man follow. Curiosity? Fear? Trust? "The next time he falls behind, we knock him out," Quinn mutters to him once they catch up. She looks regretful, but that won't stop her from doing what needs to be done. Yusuf tightens his grasp on the cloak and doesn't answer. They slip through a servant's corridor, up a winding staircase, and down another. Quinn leads them without hesitation. In the next hallway, they hear thudding footsteps approaching. Quinn slips behind a bizarre stone statue that looks vaguely like a camel without legs, and Yusuf pulls the man into an unlit alcove. In the shadows, he wastes a second deciding if he dares cover the man's mouth with his hand. Then there are guards going past, and he can only hold his breath. The man stays silent and still as the grave, pressed up against the wall, as though he might fuse with it. His eyes dart from guard to guard, fear obvious on his face, keeping his gaze on the guards, who are, thankfully, not doing a very thorough job of patrolling. Yusuf releases the cloak in favor of curling a gentle hand around the man's wrist. The man jolts at the touch but makes no sound. They stand like that for a long minute, waiting as the noise of the footsteps dies away in the echoing hall. The man is cold to the touch. Yusuf can feel the rapid beat of his heart through the delicate skin of his wrist. When they move on, Yusuf doesn't let go. By the time Quinn stops them at a large but plain door, clearly not one Gabor or his guests typically use, the man is stumbling over his feet every few steps. "He's exhausted," Yusuf whispers worriedly to Quinn. "Is it much further?" "Andromache is supposed to have the horses right outside," she murmurs back. "Wait." She cracks the door open and slips through. A moment later, she pops her head back in and waves them forward. Yusuf leads the man to the door, letting him use Yusuf's hold on his wrist to rebalance himself when he wobbles. "We will be on horses soon," Yusuf says. He frowns. "I hope you know how to ride." The man stops dead in the doorway, blinded by the direct light of the setting sun. The arm holding the dagger raises to cast a shadow over his eyes. His mouth drops open as he stares. They are standing between a large overgrowth of tree-like bushes and the curving wall at the base of a tower, relatively hidden away on three sides from the majority of the grounds. Before them, rolling lawns stretch out for ages, the long grass rippling in the evening breeze. Gently sloped hills rise up in the distance, thick with trees. The air is hazy with sunlight, and the deepening blue sky above is bleeding into a brilliant orange above the hills. Yusuf does not blame the man for staring. If merely the light of the setting sun was enough to distract the man from escape, how overwhelming must this beautiful scene be? "You armed him," Andromache comments dryly. "I suppose that is a good sign." She stands a few paces away, several horses at her side idly grazing at the grass. Their three horses are there, plus a fourth. Their saddlebags are packed. No one but the cell guards have seen them yet. The plan is going smoothly so far. His fingers still on the man's wrist. Yusuf notices the spike in his pulse a split second too late. Attention torn away from the landscape, the man catches sight of Andromache, and he clearly remembers her. He rips his wrist from Yusuf's grasp and stumbles several steps away, not back inside, but with his back to the tower wall. His lips curl up to show his gritted teeth, and he holds the dagger at the ready. "Shit," Yusuf says. "Ah," says Andromache. "I told you it was a bad idea to kill him," Yusuf hisses. Entirely unruffled, Andromache raises an eyebrow. "You killed him." He sends her an unimpressed look. "Not within the last 3 days. I also fed him and washed him and freed him from his chains." She shrugs, dismissing the details as beneath her. "Then we will have to find some chains for me to get him out of." "Enough," Quinn interrupts, exasperated. "We need to go." They all turn back to the man. He is fully pressed up against the wall and only has eyes for Andromache. "Get him on the horse," she orders. When Yusuf opens his mouth to protest, she warns, "Or I will, one way or another." "Show him that you're like him, like me," Yusuf blurts. "It may help." Andromache frowns, but she pulls a knife from her boot without question. The man makes his rough growling noise, and Yusuf's hopes dip for more than one reason. Not only will the man's mistrust of Andromache hinder their escape, but he is also still making that wordless sound, even though he is no longer muzzled. Is he incapable of speech? Ignoring the man's threat posturing, Andromache slices deep into her own forearm before handing the knife to Quinn. She strides forward, approaching the man steadily with her arm outstretched, her hand palm down. "You see," she says, softer than when she was speaking to Yusuf. She halts when she's still several steps away and wipes the blood away. "Healed." The man goes silent, eyes fixed on her arm. From her place by the horses, Quinn slashes the knife across her palm. Blood drips from her fist. She squats to scrub her hand on the grass and then holds her palm up for inspection, smooth and unharmed. The man watches all this with lessening suspicion and growing uncertainty. His arms shake under the weight of the dagger. Yusuf steps forward and carefully takes his wrist again, wincing when the man flinches at his touch. "Come," he says. "We will explain later. Please trust us." Andromache turns away to mount her horse. Her retreat takes away some of the tension in the man's body, and he lets himself be tugged towards the horse they acquired for him. She's a gentle-looking mare, waiting patiently as Yusuf takes several tries to guide the man's foot into the stirrup. The man examines the horse with a furrowed brow, then glances down at the dagger in his hand. "I will keep it for you," Yusuf offers, holding out his hand. The man ignores him. He hauls himself up onto the horse with shaking arms and little grace, one hand on the saddle and the other clutching Yusuf's dagger. He doesn't quite make it up. Clinging to the saddle, he lists precariously back towards the ground. Yusuf instinctively throws up his hands to catch him, but the man drops the dagger and grabs wildly for another handhold, catching himself. Yusuf risks placing a hand on his back to help shove him the rest of the way into the saddle. Once seated, it seems muscle memory takes over. The man sits easily astride the horse, his hands loosening their frantic grip. He looks almost dazed as he leans forward to pet at the horse's neck, an absent-minded gesture that squeezes at Yusuf's heart. Something of the man is still in there, and it's something kind. "Yusuf!" barks Andromache, long since mounted. Yusuf jumps, scooping up the abandoned dagger from the ground and hurrying to mount his own horse. They don't have time for him to stand around lost in thought. Quinn takes the reins from the man's horse and hands them up to Yusuf. "You had better lead him," she says, flashing him a smile. "I think he likes..." She is cut off by a bolt piercing through her shoulder. Yusuf cries out in surprise. Quinn does not. She drops to a crouch, with her narrowed eyes scanning the area, one hand already going to the bolt shaft to yank at it. A group of guards on foot charges from around the castle wall, most with swords drawn and a few with crossbows at the ready. They've been found out. Andromache swears loudly, spurring her horse around. "Go!" she shouts to Yusuf. She smacks his horse's rump as she passes him on her way to support Quinn. Yusuf's horse jumps forward. He holds tightly to his two sets of reins as they leap into motion, trying to guide his horse and lead the other simultaneously. A crossbow bolt whizzes past his head, and he jerks his horse to one side. He hurriedly glances back to check. The man is still on his horse, thankfully, despite the sudden start. His hands are gripped tightly in the horse's mane as he leans over her neck. His long hair is covering his face and whipping around in the wind, so it's a good thing he doesn't need to steer. Yusuf just hopes he's a good rider. They have a good head start on the guards, none of whom were mounted, and no doubt Quinn and Andromache will keep them occupied. Yusuf tries to quash his worry for them and focus on his own escape. His job is to get the man safely to their planned rendezvous point. The women can take care of themselves. He pushes the horses faster, squinting into the setting sun. The castle is quickly shrinking behind them, and the wooded hills up ahead are growing taller. He can't see anyone pursuing them yet, but it's only a matter of time. Gabor won't let his prize prisoner go without a fight. They ride for a long time. Yusuf leads them into the woods and across creeks, wading through streams, backtracking and circling. A man with a menagerie like Gabor's almost certainly has hunting dogs at his disposal. Yusuf has to confuse their trail as much as possible. He pushes them hard while they're still light to see, then slows as the night creeps in. Through it all, the man keeps his seat. At some point, Yusuf looks back to see the man slumped over his horse's neck, his arms wrapped around, and his face hidden in the mane. Though Yusuf wants to stop and check on him, he can't justify it to himself. As long as the man stays on the horse, they have to keep going until they're safe. Finally, Yusuf reaches the spot Quinn had described. There's the tree splitting into three trunks. There's the moss-covered boulder that looks a little like a teacup, and there are the symbols she scratched into both. The foliage is thick here, bushes exploding in between the many trees. He leads the horses through a gap in the bushes, and they emerge into a small clearing, ringed with towering plants. Yusuf dismounts and allows himself a minute just to breathe. His horse noses at his shoulder, and he gives her a pat. "Thank you, sweet one," he murmurs to her. "You worked hard today." Navigating only by the light of the rising moon, Yusuf moves the horses off to one side. He'll take care of them in a minute, but first, "Brother," Yusuf whispers, approaching the man's horse. He hasn't seen the man move in ages and wonders if he passed out. "We're stopping here for the night." The man doesn't react, face still buried in his horse's mane. Yusuf decides to get their bedrolls ready before trying again. Andromache stole an extra from storage in the guards' quarters, used on their rare patrols of Gabor's lands, most likely, so they each have a place to sleep. He places them close together for safety and warmth. They can't risk a fire, so their blankets will have to do. He loosens his horse's gear, apologizing in whispers for not taking everything off. They need to be ready for a quick escape. Quinn has the horse feed, so he can't feed them either. They crop at the lush grass and don't seem too bothered. Rudimentary campsite ready. Yusuf goes back to the man and reaches out to shake his shoulder gently. "Wake up." The man jolts awake, startling upright and nearly falling off the horse. "Shit," Yusuf says, instinctively throwing his hands out to help steady the man, then snatching them back when he realizes that's part of the problem. "It's all right. You're safe. Don't worry." The man's eyes are bright in the moonlight, staring back at him from beneath unruly locks of hair. His breath is fast but quiet. "You see?" Yusuf steps back. "You know me. We're safe. We can sleep now." The man makes no move, his eyes darting around the clearing. In the gloom, hardly anything is visible. "Come," Yusuf says, extending a hand in invitation. "You'll sleep better on the ground, I think." He reaches up and tugs gently on the cloak. The man does not so much dismount as he does slip off the back of the horse, landing heavily and staggering on weak knees. Yusuf tries to steady him with the hand on his back, but the man flinches away. He uses his grip on the cloak to coax the man over to the bedrolls. "This is yours," he says, patting one. He lies down on his own bedroll demonstratively. "Come, rest." The man remains where he is, swaying slightly in place. He glances nervously around the clearing, head jerking as he alternates between looking at Yusuf and looking behind himself. It feels like the bedroll is pulling Yusuf into slumber. His body is relaxing, and his brain is shutting off. Beyond tired himself by now, Yusuf is half tempted to just go to sleep and let the man figure it out. He scolds himself for the uncharitable thought. "Patience," he reminds himself. He makes his weary limbs move, getting back off his bedroll and dragging it a pace away. He catches sight of the horses. "Go on. Lie down," he says as he heads to the stolen horse, giving the man a wide berth. He loosens the horse's gear as he'd done for his own, patting her in thanks for handling her sleeping passenger so well. The man is still standing when Yusuf finishes. He watches, unblinking, as Yusuf lies back down on his own bedroll. Then his head swivels, his attention turning to the empty space behind him. Yusuf holds in a sigh and tries to force his tired brain to solve the problem. He holds his eyes open through force of will, watching the man practically turn in circles to keep an eye on his surroundings. "Oh." Yusuf props himself up on an elbow. "Is that it?" The man's gaze snaps back to him. "Two out in the open." He gets up, trying to ignore how the man flinches back a step, and proceeds to drag both bedrolls over to the opposite end of the clearing from the horses. He puts one right up against the thick bushes. He lies down on the other with a groan. "Come on, try it," he urges, pointing to the man's bedroll. "It's not much, but it's better than the ground." and given that the man has been sleeping naked on a stone floor for who knows how long, a bedroll on grass will probably feel like heaven. Despite his best efforts, Yusuf nearly falls asleep before the man moves again. His eyes have slipped closed without his noticing, and his breathing has evened out. He hears a slight rustling, as of feet in grass, and then quiet. Several heartbeats go by before some more rustling comes. Yusuf remains still and quiet, listening as the man slowly creeps onto the bedroll. When no sound comes for a good minute, he cracks his eyes open. In the dimness, he can make out a blanket-covered lump with a mop of hair at one end. There's a glitter from within the darkness, the man's pale eyes ever watching. Putting his back to the shrubbery seems to have done the trick. He's on the bedroll now, at least. "Comfortable," Yusuf murmurs. He looks up at the stars through the clearing's gap in the tree canopy. "I'm not looking at you," he's trying to say without words. "You're safe. You can sleep." When he looks back again, the man is staring up at the night sky. His eyes shine with moonlight and perhaps something else. "Has it been a while since you last saw the stars?" Yusuf snuggles deeper beneath his blanket and sighs contentedly. "They are beautiful." In the silence of the night, watching the stars side by side, Yusuf feels strangely at peace, like he has been here before, like they have been here before. "Sleep well," Yusuf whispers. "Please don't leave in the night." The man gives no reply. Moments later, Yusuf falls asleep to the sound of his breathing. Chapter 13. Interlude. Nicolo. An ear-splitting screech jerks Nicolo from his nap, where he had been dozing, sitting up against the wall of the jail. Half blinded by the afternoon sun shining through the single tall, thin window, he squints in the direction of the door and wishes someone would get around to oiling the hinge. Two men enter, walking down the short corridor flanking the cells, separated only by a metal fence. First comes the jailer, a squat man with a ruddy face permanently twisted into a scowl. Following him is someone Nicolo has never seen before, a large man, wearing respectable clothing and an anticipatory expression. The jailer glances around, checking that the cell door is still locked and Nicolo hasn't gotten up to anything since the last check-in a few hours ago. The other man only has eyes for Nicolo. "Hello," Nicolo says politely in Sabir when no one speaks. He hasn't had a friendly conversation since the fruit seller in the last town, who chatted with him about the impending rain. Not many in this part of the world can speak the languages Nicolo is fluent in, but he's been getting by with the pidgin language. The jailer shoots him a quelling look and turns to the visitor, asking something gruffly. The man ignores him. "Stand up, please," he says to Nicolo. He speaks Sabir with an accent different from Nicolo's. Since he asked nicely enough, Nicolo sees no reason to refuse. They've been treating him well enough here so far, giving him regular meals and not harassing him over much. He rises to his feet. His ass is numb from sitting so long on the hard floor. The man scans him up and down, a hand on his chin, critically examining Nicolo like he's livestock. Beginning to rethink his obedience, Nicolo fights the urge to shift in place under the scrutiny. He stands tall, making no attempt to straighten his simple clothing. Whatever is happening here, he will face it head on. The man meets his gaze. "I heard you fought three men at the same time," he says, leaning in. "Is that true?" "Yes," Nicolo answers honestly. "Killed them?" "Yes." He does not regret it. They were harassing a young girl at the cusp of womanhood, going so far as to touch her lower back and hold her in place by her arm. He hadn't intended for it to get bloody, but the men drew their blades first and forced his hand. That is what he tells himself, anyway. He likely could have wounded them non-fatally if he had tried harder. It is one of his greatest shames that he is able to kill without hesitation. Despite his regrets, despite swearing to do better, be better, Perhaps he is still too quick to violence. Perhaps he was meant for it. He only regrets the fact that he hadn't run afterwards, at the time believing the witnesses around them would vouch for what happened. He's had a lot of time to think about his naivete during the last few days in this jail cell. How could he have thought an outsider with no connections could kill three locals without repercussions, provoked or otherwise? At least no one seems to notice that the slice on his bicep had disappeared. "You are good with a sword," the man continues. He says something else that Niccolo can't quite parse. Pausing at Niccolo's frown, he tries again with different words. "Either stupid or brave." "Brave is better." He smiles, a deliberate, practiced expression. Niccolo does not reply, waiting with mild curiosity to hear what the man wants. He has always been a patient man. In these days, he has nothing but time. He already decided he can't go home. All that is left to him now is to live out the rest of his life as a wanderer, helping people whenever he can. He suspects, however, that this man doesn't seek the kind of help Niccolo is willing to provide. He doesn't have to wait long. The man nods to himself and appears to come to a decision. Turning to the jailer, the man says something in the local tongue. The jailer nods disinterestedly and holds out a hand. The man pulls out a fat purse. "Excuse me," Niccolo says, apprehension beginning to sour his stomach. "What is happening?" The man doesn't look away from the coins he's counting out into the jailer's hand. "I pay the cost of your crimes," he says magnanimously. Money exchanged, he turns back with a pleased smile. "And you help me with my new business." The jailer pockets the coins and pulls out a ring of keys, searching through them for the one to Niccolo's cell. Niccolo ignores him in favor of staring down the rich man. "Will I?" he asks flatly. The man's smile remains in place. "Yes, otherwise you will be killed," he gestures to the jailer. "Executed," he means. Niccolo clenches his jaw and looks away, considering the situation. No one had told Niccolo what they intended for him. He doesn't know how long this strange gift of his will last, or what its limits are, but he knows it's unlikely to escape notice if he resurrects after a public execution. There's no telling how bad that would be. Getting out of this cell needs to be his first priority. "What sort of business?" Niccolo asks suspiciously as the jailer shuffles forward to unlock his cell. The man's smile grows wider. "One that needs fighters, like you." He tucks his purse away and rocks back on his heels, hands clasped over his stomach. "You will fight for me, and if you do well, you will be rewarded." "I am not a soldier," Niccolo says sharply. He will not fall into that trap again. 4 months he went where he was told, following orders and asking precious few questions. He'd shoved down his growing doubts as the gory reality of war began to chase away the fog of glory from his eyes. He fought the men he was told to fight up until death claimed him before the gates of Jerusalem. And when heaven's doors and hell's remained barred to him, he had picked up his sword and would have continued on as before if it hadn't been for what awaited him behind the walls. It was the horrors he saw inside the holy city that finally forced him to see many truths he had denied. The day when Niccolo had balanced out his sins in the Holy Land may never come. But ever since Jerusalem, he has been doing his utmost to put some good into the world, even if, it seems, he is only capable of good through violence. He will not let himself be used as a tool of indiscriminate destruction again. But the rich man shakes his head and says, "I do not want soldiers." The cell door swings open. The only barriers to Niccolo's freedom now are the two men before him and the guards in the front room. But he's not about to attack lawmen for doing their job. Besides, his sword is nowhere to be seen. He may be unable to die, but that doesn't make him invulnerable. Going quietly is his best strategy for now. He stares at the man, trying to read him past the placating smile. "Who are you?" he asks. "My name is Emil," says the man. Emil nods towards the door. "Come, we will reach an understanding soon." Niccolo grimaces as he peels off his overtunic, disliking the way the bloodied fabric sticks to his skin. Yet another evening of sewing awaits him. He throws the shirt into the bucket of water to soak before the blood stains set in too deeply, then begins to scrub his dirty but unharmed skin. Today's fights had not been overly difficult, but one opponent got in a hit with a clever move Niccolo had never seen before. One moment, Niccolo was parrying with his blade, and the next, blood was pouring from a deep slice to his shoulder. He disarmed the man shortly after, even though Emil would likely be displeased with him for not drawing out the fight further. His chest and arms mostly free of blood, Niccolo sinks down onto his cot with a sigh. His body droops with exhaustion. A strange sensation vibrates just under his skin, the feeling that his muscles should be sore and aching. But he feels no pain, only a deep-seated weariness that grows by the day. He glances towards the small window he has been afforded, far too narrow to fit his shoulders through. The sun is beginning to set. He will have to begin sewing soon if he doesn't want to be doing it blind. The markets are likely closing up. He could hear people's voices as they shuffle past, cheerful and disgruntled in turns. He can't understand much of what they're saying. Emil only speaks to him in the basic Sabir they share, and hardly anyone else will speak to him. So his grasp of the local language has not improved these last few months. He wishes he could call out the window and ask for help. He's tried asking the people who bring food and water to his room, always accompanied by an armed guard, but they either can't understand him or refuse to. It's the same routine every time. He gets his meals, they retreat without a word, and the door locks behind them. He's beginning to think Emil will set him free before Niccolo ever manages to escape, perhaps years down the line. The security here isn't much, but Emil knows what he's doing with Niccolo. His sword is given to him only in the ring, handed over like a pre-battle ceremony instead of a precaution. Guards escort him between his room and the arena, and, most crucially, they are under instructions to kill him at a single wrong move. His healing did not stay a secret for long. Emil discovered the truth barely 2 days after buying him, having backhanded him across the face in frustration. The cut on his cheekbone from Emil's ring healed immediately, and all was lost. The public doesn't know, of course. Niccolo could hardly serve as Emil's champion, enticing others into the ring, if he were known to be unkillable. Not that the fights are to the death. Bad for business, Emil says, and Niccolo certainly would have refused to fight to kill in any case. He could barely bring himself to fight in the arena as it is. The men he is pitted against are often poorly trained, just looking for a bit of money. He doesn't like to fight them. But it does not do much good to refuse. The first time he lowered his sword mid-combat, his opponent neatly sliced through his hamstring, forcing Niccolo to one knee and winning the fight. He healed without issue. But Emil was forced to keep Niccolo out of the ring for several weeks due to supposed injury. Furious, Emil beat him bloody and left him without food for the first week or two. Niccolo has been more cooperative since then. He can't plan an escape while deliriously hungry. But even when fed, his mad dashes for freedom have failed every time thus far. It doesn't help that he is reluctant to harm the men guarding him, not wanting to punish them for doing their jobs, for protecting their employer's greatest asset. His attempts have grown few and far in between, as the prospect seems more and more hopeless. Perhaps this is his punishment, for fighting in what he thought was a holy war, for raising his blade against men only protecting their home. For his sins, he is doomed here, sentenced to spend the rest of his years fighting pointless battles, a slave with invisible shackles. He is beginning to wonder if he will ever see the sea again. or a friendly face, or anything besides these four walls and the fighting ring. Some nights, as he lies awake, staring up at the ceiling, he thinks about the odd, vivid dreams he used to have. It would be nice to dream of faraway places again, of riding horses and drinking wine. The fighting he does not miss, but watching those two imposing women do battle was a breathtaking experience. The dreams comforted him in that first terrible year after Jerusalem. Even as strange as they were, tangible in a way he'd never before felt while asleep, they brought him increasingly familiar faces, a blessing he did not deserve, but did appreciate. By day, he wandered unfamiliar lands, meeting suspicion and distrust at every turn, seeking only to find enough food to eat and to do penance for his sins. By night, he dreamt of rolling hills and crashing waves, of uninhibited laughter and fond smiles. Not every dream is like this. Sometimes he dreams of a home he'll never see again. Other times the dreams are nonsensical, strange blurs of illogical happenings and ridiculous conversations. And sometimes he sees the face of the first man to kill him, sees the curl falling over that forehead, loses himself in those deep brown eyes as his lifeblood pours warm and heavy from his body, watches the eyes widen in surprise as blood spurts from that throat. They fall together, and then Niccolo wakes. Perhaps he has that man to thank for opening his eyes, death and resurrection granting him a second chance at life. Now that the dreams are gone, he wonders how pathetic his loneliness must have been to invent people to keep him company at night. He wonders if he is meant to be less lonely now. Perhaps he shouldn't feel so sorry for himself. It's not so bad here. He gets fed more or less regularly, and he has his own room and bed. He gets plenty of exercise, what with training and the fights. Emile even lets him shave every week or two, strictly supervised, if he hasn't done anything to earn the man's ire. There are others who have it far worse. Niccolo remembers when he used to be so certain that God had a plan for him, that Niccolo could serve, could do his part to execute God's will. Even after Jerusalem, he clung to the belief that his life could still have meaning. Perhaps this is all he is meant for, all he is good for. Voices approach in the hall. Niccolo waits tiredly for Emile to enter, likely to berate him for his performance today. He can't muster the energy to worry about what his punishment might be. What is a little pain, a little hunger to him anymore? It's all the same. Every day is the same. Emile does come in, but he's followed by a man Niccolo has never seen before. A guard with his sword already drawn is the last one inside. The door shuts behind them, leaving the four men crammed into a room meant for one. Niccolo sits up straight on his cot, paying attention now. "He here," Emile announces with a proud smile, as though Niccolo is something he can claim credit for. But what surprises him is that Emile says it in a language Niccolo learned from his fellow soldiers, though his accent is thick and unpracticed. The unknown man steps closer. He is dressed in obvious finery, draped in rich cloths, jewels adorning his fingers, and the dagger in his belt. His blonde hair is neat, his beard close-cropped, his eyes glitter unpleasantly. "I have heard some interesting things from my host," the man says softly in the same language. His pronunciation is better than Emile's, but still stilted like he hasn't done much speaking. Even so, the relief of hearing a language he's fluent in washes over Niccolo like a wave of warm water. The man's voice is smooth and light, his tone welcoming a conversation. Niccolo doesn't trust him.
"Further, I understand you may be overstaying your welcome," the man continues, his formality clashing with the circumstances. What kind of man stands over a half-naked, reluctant gladiator in his cell and spouts such academic verbiage? Niccolo holds back a snort only through force of polite habit. "I would gladly take my leave of this generous hospitality," he says acerbically,
glad to be able to speak in full, intelligent sentences, if Emile would be so kind as to allow it. The man smiles, a brief upturning of his lips that looks entirely unamused. Be quiet, Emile snaps in Sabir, his face darkening, or I cut out your tongue.
Nicola will likely pay for that comment later in the form of a withheld meal or two. He finds he doesn't much care.
The guard remains silent and watchful in the corner. He has killed Niccolo before and would no doubt be willing to do so again if required. The unfamiliar man edges nearer, his eyes running over every bit of Niccolo's half-clothed body as though searching for something. He talks back, does he? He murmurs almost absent-mindedly. I can fix that. Niccolo is opening his mouth to respond when, without warning, the man swiftly draws his dagger. Niccolo is barely able to stand before the man's blade is at his throat. He stills, gaze locked on the man's chilly eyes as he waits for death to bite. But the dagger doesn't pierce his throat. The man lowers the blade to his bare chest and drags the tip slowly, painfully, across his skin. A line of blood wells up from his collarbone, down his sternum. Niccolo grits his teeth and bides his time. The growing resentment reignites his desire to be free. He can withstand whatever this man throws at him. He will heal, and then he will get out of here, and it will be like it never happened. My, the man murmurs. He steps back again, eyes glued to Niccolo's already healed chest. He wipes his dagger on an embroidered handkerchief without looking away. You are special, aren't you? Niccolo says nothing, staring back with all the defiance that burns steadily in his heart. His anger is casting light into the darkness of his apathy, stirring his blood in a way he hasn't felt in months. The urge to fight and the urge to flee battle within him. He wants to wipe that smile off this man's face. He wants to run far away and forget he was ever here. He wants to sit back down and rest for a year. The man sheathes his dagger and finally drags his gaze away, looking to Emile as his smile widens. Very special indeed. They call him Beast. He learns this a few weeks into his latest imprisonment, the exact time being difficult to track without daylight. He never thought he would miss his room at Emile's arena with its tiny window and the sounds of life beyond it. He doesn't speak their language. Unfamiliar words buzz around him whenever he isn't being smothered in silence. They bark orders at him, coo sickeningly in his ears, whisper things he can't comprehend. He doesn't need to understand their words to know when they're taunting him. But their name for him he knows. Gabor can speak a language Niccolo knows, after all, and he casually informs Niccolo of his new name during one of his daily visits, or what Niccolo assumes are days. You are my most special beast, Gabor announces gleefully, watching Niccolo's face greedily for a reaction. His gloved hand reaches out to caress Niccolo's cheek, the leather cool and soft against his skin. Be a good little beast for me, yes? Kneeling on the floor, hands bound, his back still stinging from Gabor's knife play, Niccolo feels like he's drifting outside of himself. The room is spinning lazily. His empty stomach aches. His mouth is as dry as a desert. At first, he responded to Gabor's taunts with insults, and then he moved on to reciting psalms to keep himself centered. And finally, he fell silent. He is not sure he could speak without a drink of water. Gabor's other hand trails his favorite dagger down Niccolo's chest, the tip just barely touching him. The cold metal brushes past his stomach, down into the patch of curly hair, coming to rest at the base of his naked cock. They took his clothes from him the very first day. Niccolo feels horribly exposed beneath Gabor's calculating eyes. The dagger tip presses harder, pain beginning to spark. From somewhere within the haze of oversensitivity and exhaustion, fury begins to boil deep in his core. A beast? If that is what Gabor wants, that Nicola will obey just this once and give it to him. He jerks his head and catches the meat of Gabor's hand between his teeth. He clenches down hard, struggling to bite through the leather as Gabor shouts his surprise. Red hot pain slices across his throat, and he is falling to the floor with a fierce grin curled around the hand in his mouth. They bring in the muzzle the next day. He doesn't know what it is at first. It's a jumble of metal and leather in the hands of a guard. He's focused more on Gabor, ever the greatest threat, and still very angry. "You will be obedient," Gabor spits, one hand resting possessively on the hilt of the sword in his belt, the sword he barely knows how to handle, the sword he likes to show off undeservedly just to draw Niccolo's ire. "If I must beat obedience into you, I shall. You will learn, little beast." "I am no beast," Niccolo grits out. He's shackled tightly to the wall, his arms behind him and his ankles locked together. Having his back to the wall produces a confusing mix of emotions. He feels cornered, and yet it's reassuring not needing to anticipate an attack from behind. "And I will not obey you." "Beast, do not talk back," Gabor nods at the pair of guards who accompanied him into the cell. Niccolo tenses as they approach, but in the end there is little he can do. He struggles against his chains and curses at them even after they stab him in the neck. Darkness overtakes him, dragging him down as he fights tooth and nail to cling to life. When he wakes, at first he thinks the metallic taste in his mouth is his blood, but his tongue tries to move and cannot, coming up against something hard and unmoving. His eyes fly open, and he instinctively tries to speak. A wordless noise comes out instead, an incomprehensible moan. Something pulls at his hair and presses into his cheeks. He shakes his head, but it refuses to dislodge. Gabor is watching him, his anger hardening his eyes even as he smiles. "You see," he says, "you will learn." With the muzzle on, Niccolo can no longer talk back. He had learned early on to keep his mouth closed as much as possible, only speaking when no one was near to shove a painful instrument, or worse, part of themselves, into his resisting mouth. But now he has no choice in the matter. He continues to ignore Gabor's orders, and the familiar language tapers off as Gabor focuses more on inflicting pain than on breaking his will. His urge to respond diminishes as well, the defiant words appearing in his mind less and less frequently as his ability to speak languishes. Speech quickly becomes something that is only used to hurt him, not for him to understand, not for him to speak, only for his torturers to amuse themselves. Eventually he stops listening at all. Their voices are only sound. Language is beyond him now. During one visit, as he lies breathless on the cold floor, his own blood warm and sticky beneath him, Niccolo wonders hazily if Gabor aims to turn him mad. Perhaps the sadist hopes to first make a beast of him, then tame him. He will not be tamed, but he cannot help the increasing number of animalistic behaviors. His voice emerges from his throat in grunts and moans, speech lost to him. When the grime covering him begins to itch, he is forced to rub up against the walls for relief. Surely they will take the muzzle off once Gabor thinks he has learned his lesson, Niccolo thinks at first. They will take it off so he may eat. They do not. Gabor waits until he is starving, until his stomach aches and cramps and his mouth burns with dryness. Then he waits some more, tormenting Niccolo by bringing his own meals into the cell and eating them with relish while Niccolo's stomach cries out. Finally, he brings him a bucket. Niccolo looks in warily. The bucket contains something soft, light-colored, and lumpy. It does not smell like much, but it's food. His stomach growls and his mouth does its best to moisten itself. His arms are still bound behind his back. The muzzle still wraps cruelly around his face. He is too hungry to care about humiliation. Dropping to his knees, Nicholas shoves his face into the bucket and begins slurping up food as fast as he can through his half-open mouth. It's difficult without the full use of his tongue or lips. He barely pauses to breathe, desperate to fill his stomach. He hears Gabor's low chuckle, but he doesn't realize how close the man has gotten until there is a hand in his hair. It grips tightly and yanks his head up. He glares, swallowing his last mouthful with an audible gulp. Food drips from his cheeks and chin, spattering on the floor. "You may eat when you cooperate," Gabor tells him, shifting his grip to pet Nicolo's head. "Are you ready to be good?" Nicolo attempts to headbutt his groin. Gabor dodges and bludgeons him upside the head with the hilt of his dagger. He falls, knocking the bucket over and spilling half its remaining contents to the ground. "You will learn," Gabor says again, patiently. He takes the bucket with him when he leaves. Alone, Nicolo sucks the spilled food from the floor and does not feel ashamed until he's done. He shivers against the cold stone floor, curled into as much of a ball as he can with his arms chained to the wall. His body does not ache, yet he feels phantom wounds scarring his skin. His newly grown beard prickles against his knees, itchy beneath the straps of the muzzle. "Is that a noise outside?" He holds his breath, staring in the direction of the door, even though his eyes see nothing but black. Seconds pass as his heart beats faster. When his lungs ache and he could no longer stand it, he exhales and thinks maybe he misheard. There is no one there. Not right now. Gabor has taken to inviting others in to play. At first, he hoped one of the guests would draw back in horror at Gabor's cruelty, would take pity on him. None of them ever did. He has learned their faces, their features etched in his mind and haunting his fragmented sleep. The one with the patchy russet beard and booming laugh means slow torture. He likes to impale him and watch him squirm as his body attempts to heal around the intrusion. The woman with a thin face, who never smiles, likes to beat him with her hands, slapping and pinching and choking him until his eyes bug out and the room fades. The pale man with the missing tooth means fire. He flinches away from the thought as his own screams echo in his memories. There is no one here right now. It is dark and silent, and he is alone. He rocks from side to side, aching to wrap his arms around himself in a pathetic excuse for an embrace, but he is not allowed even that. He huddles back against the wall, taking comfort in its reliable presence at his back. Gabor likes to wait. His torturer has him chained in place, then circles him slowly for what feels like hours. Gabor sits out of sight, saying nothing, only to catch him unawares just when he is beginning to sag from the exhaustion of remaining tense for so long. The anticipation is nearly as bad as the pain. After that, the first blow of a whip cracking down across his shoulders or a knife stabbing through his foot brings a sick sense of relief that the uncertainty is over. Sometimes, Gabor does nothing at all. Teeth bared around the muzzle, he glares at his cruel master, attempts to lunge at him against the chains, lets out a threatening noise in lieu of speech, anything to get him to do something. Gabor just watches with a smile lingering on his lips. He stands and watches and does nothing, eventually sweeping out of the room without a word. It leaves him feeling like an animal in a circus, Gabor's soulless gaze piercing through him and pinning him to the cell floor. It leaves him feeling bereft and adrift, just waiting until the resumption of pain brings his world back into familiar territory. Another noise from the hallway. He jerks his head up, wincing at the quiet jangle of his chains from the movement. He holds his breath again, as though no one will know he is here if he makes no sound. There is a metallic clanking at the door. His pulse races, Someone is here. Someone is here for him. The door swings open slowly, a curtain of blinding light falling across the walls of his cell. He squeezes his eyes shut and curls up tighter. Gabor's voice says something short from the doorway. He cringes at the sound. Heavy footsteps approach, and his heart is going to pound out of his chest. Hands roughly grasp at his limbs, holding his weak arms behind his back as a scraping noise sounds in the lock. They drag him away from the wall, the burn of his skin against the stone barely noticeable as he anticipates much greater pain. He tries to fight, awkwardly moving frozen limbs, kicking out desperately and twisting his torso out of their grip. His breath rushes out of him in frantic pants. Voices snap at him, and something hard hits him upside the head. The light behind his eyelids goes dark. He wakes, already trembling, as he immediately registers the weight of the restraints against his ankles, his wrists. The floor is cold beneath his shins and forearms. The open air chills his naked, unprotected back. No, no, no. He draws back into himself as Gabor's laugh rings out, barbed and wicked. Beast, he hears, long since recognizing the word. Gabor has not spoken to him in a language he can understand, for he doesn't know how long. He can't remember the last time he heard a sentence he could understand, the last time he heard a kind word, the last time anyone said his name. Niccolo, that is his name. He clings to it now, tries to recall the sound of his mother's voice when she called for him. Someone used to know his name. Someone used to speak to him in a gentle tone that was not accompanied by agony. Someone used to care for him. Gabor's hand alights on Niccolo's back, and he flinches as a dark chuckle seeps into every corner of his being. No. No, no, no. Niccolo withdraws. There is a space deep within himself, shrouded in layers of forced blindness and deafness, somewhere he could dull the sensations and detach himself from the present. There he can find some semblance of apathy. The pain still reaches him, but it is almost as though it is happening to someone else. Someone else shudders under unwanted touch, throws his body unrelentingly against his chains, screams with his mouth. He has nowhere pleasant to go in his memories, no dreams to sweep him to someplace far away. Unable to escape, unable to fight, Niccolo begins to disappear. The door opens. He does not move, eyes narrowed against the light and ears straining for every sound. Footsteps approach, that awful voice echoing against the walls. He tenses his limbs, tracking the shadowy figure before him, waiting. There is no use struggling yet. There is never a use in struggling, but he will do it anyway when opportunity presents itself or when his fear overrides all. Something gleams, sharpness at his throat. He holds still, waiting. A soft hand cups his chin, an intimate gesture that makes him want to snap his teeth. Metal bites painfully into his lips when he tries. There comes the laugh that haunts him, familiar and foreboding. The light moves, entering the darkness of his cell and burning down on him from high above as more footsteps thud on the stone. More voices, some low and recognizable, one high and shrill. The familiar sound of a hand slapping hard against flesh rings out without any accompanying pain. It's followed by a cry nearly drowned beneath laughter. The man, Gabor, he knows that name, will forever flinch away from it, is saying something. He opens his eyes wider, blinking the tears away as the brightness blazes. Gabor smiles at him, reaches out one hand to worm behind his drawn-up legs, cupping his soft cock. He hisses, trying to twist away. The hand tightens painfully, then relaxes its grip as another hand holds him in place. He struggles weakly, but tires easily, his limbs going slack as he pants for breath. The hand is stroking his cock, sending sickening tendrils of wrongness up into his stomach. Gabor's voice is soft. He hates the feeling of it in his ears. The hand lets go. It moves up to his face and pats his cheek. Then there is a burst of pain in his head, and the light and voices go away. The light is back behind his eyelids. There is the unfamiliar voice from before, high-pitched and rapid. The sound of the door closing has his eyes snapping open, looking around for his latest visitor. Gabor is gone. None of the men with weapons are here. The light is nearly blinding from where it hangs up on the wall, but he can see well enough. Only one person remains, standing by the door. He huddles back instinctively into the wall, freezing when his arms do not press against his back. He moves them, tentatively at first, then hurrying to draw them in front of his chest. The chains are gone. He wraps his arms around his vulnerable belly, even as he struggles to comprehend the lack of restraints. The person in his cell is short, light hair tumbling down their back. Their fist is pounding against the door as they cry out. A sharp voice from outside and a loud thud rattling the door makes them step back and go silent. He waits, holds himself tightly, coughs once, hoarsely, against the perpetual dryness in his throat. The person whirls around, making him jump. He bares his teeth warningly around the muzzle, letting out a low noise deep in his throat despite the painful scratchiness. The woman, for he notices that she is one now, presses back against the door, a hand to her mouth. The other hand splays low in front of her, just below her belly. Neither of them moves. He knows these waiting games. Normally it is Gabor playing them, but he knows what waiting means. Only a delay to the pain. This woman must be doing the same. His gaze darts around her, taking everything in. No visible weapons. She is naked, he notes. None of the women have been naked before. Though the men... He growls again, and to his confusion, he is answered with a whimper. That is the sort of sound he makes, not his visitors. His hands tighten on his sides. No chains, he remembers. The chains only go away when he is taken out of here, and they are replaced with other restraints while he is moved. He has never been in here without chains. His arms are never his to use. He doesn't understand. He doesn't need to. He will use this advantage ruthlessly. He can feel the weights on his ankles still locking them loosely together, but he is not tethered to the wall. His arms are free. He does not need to wait for her to attack first. He scrambles out of his huddle, limbs ungainly, after uncountable time curled stiffly into himself. He lunges forward before his feet are fully under him, relishing the burn in his muscles that comes from his own power instead of flames. The woman does not move before he reaches her, her eyes wide and dripping. His hands are on her heaving shoulders, gripping as tightly as he can with fingers still numb from the chains. He could slide them up to her throat and squeeze, as so many have done to him before. He could beat his fists into her face until she falls limply to the floor. He could tear out her throat with his fingernails, maybe. Anything to make her body stop, to halt her pain-bringing hands, and shut off her laughing voice. But something makes him wait. Tears drip down her cheeks and over the hands she is still clasping tightly over her mouth. He hears shuddering breaths, feels her shoulders tremble beneath his hands. She is not laughing. He brings up one hand to pry hers away from her face, nearly distracted by the sensation of his hands touching another. She shuts her eyes tightly. She is not smiling, either. She is not saying a word. He scans her up and down. Her hand is warm and rough with calluses. It remains loosely in his grasp, unresisting, while the other remains pressed over her crotch. She does not attempt to strike him. Her body shakes. He He doesn't understand. She is in his cell. There is light and the door is shut. She is here to hurt him. His arms are not chained. He has never seen her before. Another sound spills from behind her lips. He recognizes it, even though it is not in his own voice. Something is wrong. Not the normal kind of wrong. Hesitantly, he lets go of her hand and her shoulder. Every muscle in him tenses in anticipation as he steps back, but she does not move. He retreats to the far wall where he usually stays. He stands there at the ready until she slides down the door and hides her face in her knees, arms wrapped around her legs. He drops into a crouch to preserve his strength, eyes fixed on her as he waits and waits and waits. Nothing happens. Time passes, immeasurable, as always, but for the beat of his heart and the pace of his breaths, and this time the rapid pace of hers. Gradually, her ragged breathing slows. Pale eyes peek up from behind her knees. She flinches when their gazes meet, but she doesn't look away. She says something. Her voice wavers, the sound barely making its way across the cell to his ears. His shoulders hunch up, his head tucking down instinctively, being spoken to as a prelude to pain. But though he waits, the pain does not come. She does not approach. She does not smile. She speaks again, soft and quiet. They watch each other. Gabor is unhappy when he re-enters the cell sometime later to find them at opposite ends of the room. The woman is dragged away, once again crying out. He does not move, does not watch her go, his wary eyes fixed on Gabor's frown. He ends up in the floor chains once again. He slips away a little more. The darkness is infinite. It wraps around him, spilling into every crevice, forcing itself down his throat until he chokes, burrowing into his bones. The silence screams in his ears and echoes in the barren landscape of his mind. A rhythmic pounding is his only indication that time has not stopped. Sometimes he remembers how to move his limbs. His legs will shift against each other, dry skin rasping so loudly in his ears. His eyes open uselessly. He spends countless time wiggling his fingers, terrified that if he stops, he won't be able to start again. Inevitably, the darkness swallows him down again, and he is gone. No body left to move. No mind with which to move it. Nothing. But then, something. Something is happening. The awareness filters in slowly, piercing through like drops of water through cloth. Something is happening to him. He has a body, he rediscovers, an abdomen. That is where the something is. It has been happening for as long as he knows, but only now he realizes it. What is it? He contemplates this for a long time, or perhaps not long at all. His thoughts refuse to string together, wispy and drifting. Darkness presses back in, suffocating and heavy. His mind severs its threads to thought. His body merges with the floor. All movement stops. The rhythm ends. All is still and quiet. Air forces its way back through his lungs eventually, a harsh reintroduction to his body. He wiggles his fingers now that they exist again. When he remembers to feel it, the sensation in his abdomen escapes his grasp. Cold? He thinks one moment. Rough? He wonders 3 years later. The black current rushes past, dragging him down into its depths. He has no limbs with which to struggle. He has no strength with which to fight. He sinks. He succumbs. He drowns. He gasps for breath. Painful, he decides an hour ago. The satisfaction of a mystery solved keeps him warm for a split second, or maybe a day. The chill creeps back in, slow as frost, crushing as an avalanche, burning sharper than any flame. His fingers must fall off. He thinks he hears them drop to the floor. thudding one by one hard enough to feel the vibrations in his chest. His panting breath crystallizes into stars before him, blazing bright behind his closed eyes. Hungry, he remembers after another lifetime passes. Something to do with emptiness. And teeth tearing at his stomach. The pieces do not quite fit together, but he is already drifting away again. Thoughts scattered like so much of a broken puzzle. Maybe he never thought it at all. The darkness is all there is. All there ever was. Though that does not seem right. It must be true. He doesn't know. Please, he wants to say, the words swimming up sluggishly from the depths of his unreachable memories, spilling into his mouth, but unable to move past his tongue. Something warm rolls down his cheek, startling and inexplicably frightening. He holds his breath, but nothing else comes. Nothing is exactly what comes. There is nothing at all. The deafening nothingness makes it hard to think. He finds the right connections to move his arms, instinctively wanting hands to press to the sides of his head. But maybe he didn't do it right. He wiggles his fingers, but he doesn't know if they move. His arms remain behind him, tension at his wrists and prickling pain in the waning muscle. He forgets what he was doing. The sound is too loud, ringing in his ears unrelentingly, clawing at the inside of his skull. In time, he remembers how to move his neck and beats his head against the floor. Darkness takes him away from the noise, and he is glad. Pain blazes sudden and all-consuming. It's everywhere, all at once, bright and cacophonous and too much. His ears are assaulted. His eyes are besieged. Breath does not come, or it comes too fast. He is too overwhelmed by the light to tell. He might cry out. Something tears at the inside of his dry throat. Darkness descends on him once more, but it does not last. He comes back to the world in increments. He feels air moving past his lips. He hears noises that don't break his ears. He slips back under, and he surfaces, and the light is always waiting for him on the other side of the dark. Something scrapes past his chest. No, his chest is moving. His whole body is moving, dragging across the cold, rough ground. He doesn't think he's moving it on purpose. There's a pressure on his wrists. He drowns in brightness and chokes on life. The light dims eventually. He isn't moving anymore. There's something covering him, trailing all over every inch, creeping down his sides and splashing to the floor. His mouth fills with it, and he coughs and sputters. Water. Essential and pure and serene. He drinks and drinks and drinks. The water is gone, and he wants more. The noise becomes a voice. A viscous and lukewarm thing is shoved into his mouth, and he continues to swallow on instinct. The taste of something other than dust in his own skin is shocking on his tongue. He can move his tongue. Is that strange? He swallows until nothing fills his mouth, and then he lies exhausted and cold and with an uncomfortable feeling in his stomach. Darkness creeps in again, but different. Soft. He succumbs, and it doesn't hurt. Time passes. He wakes to blinding light and deafening noise, but less so each time. He swallows what is put in his mouth. He wiggles his fingers. He sleeps. He dares open his eyes and remembers what it is to look upon another person. The sight does nothing to quell the quivering anticipation in the most visceral parts of his being. The pain in his stomach goes away. The dryness of his mouth lessens. The weakness of his limbs slowly recedes. Sometimes the water and food come back out, burning his throat or leaving his legs sticky. The voices are louder when that happens. He gets splashed with more water, cold and silky, and washing away more cobwebs in his head each time. At some point, a familiar voice makes him cringe, a smooth noise. A laugh, he thinks, makes him shudder. With the voice comes a face that he knows. He knows, but he can't remember why. Then he is being moved, his arms dragged upright and his lolling head yanked vertical by his shaggy hair. The face comes closer. A hand, soft and warm, brushes beneath his bearded chin, strokes along his cheek. He leans into it, chasing a sensation, desperate for something to touch other than cold stone. What came before this? Where are the face and voice from? What light came before the dark? Something gleams. He sees it, but he doesn't remember. Not until the pain comes. That he remembers. Pain, he knows. Hot blood spilling from his split skin. Yes, this too is familiar. He opens his mouth to scream, and it's like no time has passed at all. He drifts away. The darkness refuses to take him back, no matter how he begs wordlessly for its embrace. He wants more water. He wants the light to go away, the voice and face to go away. As the pain sharpens, so too does his mind. Even as he extracts himself from his body and lets someone else bleed in chains, he is drawing together the tattered rags of his consciousness. In between the pain and the darkness, which is simply a lack of light, different from the abyss, and the food and the water, he painstakingly rediscovers threads from the corners of space and weaves them back into place. Once, they tug his head this way and that, pulling at his hair and beard. He hears a clicking noise as bits of him painlessly drop away to the ground. Scissors, he thinks. The next time they bring him a bucket, he realizes what it is for and drags his aching body to squat over it, wanting to avoid the stickiness. The voices aren't so loud now. The next time food, solid lately, is shoved between his lips. He remembers other things that have been in his mouth. He bites down and doesn't let go. They howl and beat him about the ears and temple as blood spills hot and salty. When he wakes, he can no longer move his tongue. The next time the man comes back, he remembers the name. That voice, that face, the deliberate way of moving that makes his hackles rise. Gabor, he thinks. It swims up from his muddied memories, the word drenched in blood and slimy with horror. Gabor is back, and so is he. He escaped for a while in the dark, but no longer. He has woken back into his never-ending nightmare. His torturer rests a hand on his head. The touch makes him shiver, torn between leaping away and leaning in. Pressure tells him to bend his neck, to duck his head, to follow the path indicated to him. He ignores the gleam of the thing, the blade, held steady before his throat. He holds his eyes open wide and staring. He remembers kneeling like this before. He remembers being here, remembers his place. He does not lower his head. Gabor smiles. He is being moved. They came and took off his chains, replacing them with cuffs and ropes. He puts up a better fight than usual, feeling stronger and less hungry. They are feeding him more lately. It makes him wary. Nothing good ever comes of gifts. But he eats the food anyway. He can't help it. Even with his increased strength, they drag and shove him into the hallway. The light outside his cell blinds him, as it always does. He trips over the stairs and they laugh. Being moved is not good. Being visited is not good either, but being moved means more people, means a fight, maybe dogs. He shudders and halts in place, only moving again when there comes a hard tug at his wrists. He stumbles forward, emerging into a large room. He knows this place. The last time he was here was only a few meals ago. They tied him to a post and watched him as they ate. He remembers the feeling of food dripping down his body, the smell when the pale man pressed a white-hot poker to his skin. God, the burning. He braces himself and refuses to move. They yell at him, shoving and pulling until his body fails him and he stumbles forward once more. They force him to his knees. He hears Gabor's voice ringing out, and a seething hatred flares up in response. He lifts his head. Gabor is there, sitting above him. He fights back an instinctive flinch, unwilling to show weakness. When one of them stabs through his arm, he grunts in surprise but doesn't look away. His torturer, his owner, the face of his nightmares. He wants Gabor dead so badly he can taste it, nearly as much as he wants to never get within arm's reach of Gabor again. His fingers flex around the phantom shape of a sword hilt. His teeth ache with the desire to sink into Gabor's throat. Half-crazed with rage, he barely feels the sting of a slice down his chest. To get to Gabor, he has to get past the men holding him down, then up the platform, past the others. He glances them over briefly, a growl starting in his throat as he recognizes most of them. But then, the man at the end. He freezes, falling silent. He recognizes this man too, but not in the same way. That curly hair, the brown skin, those eyes. He knows this man. How? Then the man is looking back and he remembers. He remembers. Death all around him. Death before him. Death beside him. This man killed him once, in the hazy time before Gabor. He killed the man, too, he remembers. Why is he not afraid? His head snaps around. Gabor is moving, drawing nearer, ready to play. They beat him when he tries to attack. He fights, but they wound him and make his ears ring and his head pound. All the while, Gabor smiles, his terrible smile. He is forced to wait for the pain. Gabor speaks and taunts him with the weapon, but bides his time before the stab. The blade sinks in deeply, tearing his insides. Blood spills hot down his front. His vision blurs as his limbs tremble. He does not die. Unfamiliar feet stop in front of him. He gathers the strength to lift his head, glaring at the latest guest here to hurt him. He blinks. Another familiar face. This one has never killed him. He saw her. He knows her. But he has never met her. She is not real. She is here to hurt him. How does he know her? Her elbow is on his chest, her arms around his head, her hand on his jaw. She feels strong, but not harsh. He does not fight. Stricken with indecision. She moves and he barely feels his life severing. When he breathes again, she is looking at him. He knows the color of her eyes, but he does not know why. He watches her go. She has killed him now. He is not surprised. Every familiar face will kill him. Familiar faces mean pain, practiced and regular. Unfamiliar faces mean pain, too. He just has to wait to see what kind. Everyone who visits brings pain. He struggles when they take him away. He is stronger than he was, but he does not win. He never wins. He fights them all the way back to his cell anyway. He is a beast. He will not obey.